All right, briefly qualify. At this time, I should briefly qualify. Requirements for chairing a meeting here at Central Orlando Group Saturday night speaker meeting are 1 year continuous sobriety and have Central as your home group and have attended a group conscious meeting. I have met all three of those. The 1 year of continuous sobriety is by God's grace only. The only reason I'm here is by His grace only. I should have been dead, killed, whatever, many, many, many times over. I drank like a pig, you know. Anything and everything, it was whatever. It was fair game. Towards the end there, it was like thoughts of suicide and all the other good stuff that goes along with it. You know, my sobriety date is August 14th, 2005, and every once in a while I think that comes into my mind and it's like, wow, I can't believe I have that much time sober in this wonderful program with you wonderful people. I'm a happy camper, as John says, so I'm going to keep coming back. Thank you. This lady that I'm going to introduce that's our speaker tonight, every time I see her, every time I hear her, I just think, you know, the thought of serenity comes to my mind. I mean, she is just a very strong AA member. Central is very lucky to have her in this group. I think we all realize that whenever she speaks to us or hear, we hear from her. So I'm going to let Marilyn tell us her story.
Let's dance. Hi, my name is Marilyn. I am an alcoholic.
Hi.
I wanted to say that right away so I wouldn't forget. Wow. It's been a while. And I look around this room and there are so many faces that are familiar to me and who have been here through a large portion of my story. And I won't pick you out by name. I don't want to embarrass you. I will say something. I listened to Roger speak last week, and the first thing I want to say is the Nooners are doing a great job. And then the second thing I want to say is that he was talking about his relationship with Jim. And I want to say a little something about my relationship with Jim, because I did not do any of the things Roger did.
No better.
But I've seen Jim for a long, long time. And one day, about a year ago now, I was sitting in a noon meeting and I was just moved. You know how you can just... Everything is coming and the emotions are welling, and I finally decided I would speak. And I shared, it was St. Patrick's Day, and I knew that that day my son had hit American soil. He had been in Iraq, and I was just so pleased. And Jim came up to me and he said, you know, thank your son. And he hugged me and he said, you know, I bet you're so proud of him. And I am. I'm so proud of my son for his service. And after that, he kept saying, have you seen your son yet? Have you seen your son yet? I said, no, he's in California. I haven't seen him yet. I haven't seen him yet. Well, he moved in. And so I see my son a lot now, Jim. I wanted you to know that. Okay. The other thing I wanted to say is, and this happens to me every time, I get very nervous. I can feel my heart racing. But when I was thinking about speaking, I tried to come up with, you know, how do I want to do this? You know, do I want to talk about the men in my life? Do I want to talk about the food in my life? Do I want to, you know, all of those other things that I qualify for? And so I decided I would do what I was supposed to do and talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And so I sat down with my trusty reflections, and I want you to look. It is the big print, okay? And I do that because then if I'm caught without my glasses, I can still see it. And I also have my big book in big print, And, you know, I want you to know, for those of you that are, I'll just say I was born in the middle of the last century. And, you know, if you have a need for glasses, go right ahead and use them because I think it's great. But there's a reading on January 1st, and it's called I Am a Miracle. And I wanted to start today with I Am a Miracle. It says, the central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do for ourselves. And it goes on to explain how I had always believed in God, but I never put it into practice. And that really is the crux of my story prior to finding AA. I grew up in a very large Midwest Irish Catholic family, and I was one of those cradle Catholics. Went all the time, just like I was supposed to. I was supposed to be a good girl. And I also took on the full onslaught of guilt that goes with being a Midwest Irish Catholic. So, you know, that's a big part of my story. We have a lot of genetics. My father was an alcoholic. My mother was an alcoholic. My father's father was an alcoholic. I am not certain about my mother's father, but I do know that my father, who was the second youngest of nine, there were five boys and four girls. Four of the five boys were alcoholic. One of the girls married an alcoholic. Two of the girls became nuns. That tells you something. And the other one just decided not to get married. And, you know, so these are some things that, you know, when you wonder, what is the culture? How did I grow up? And, you know, I think a lot of times I grew up the way most people, or I thought most people grew up. My mother's father was an immigrant. Her mother died when she was 17 of cancer. Within the year, she married my father, so I'm sure that was pretty traumatic. But what they found over the years is that, what I found over the years is that they really didn't know each other very well at all. And they didn't know how to know each other very well, and they passed that down. My dad was the kind of drunk that you and I would recognize very easily and ask them to sit next to us in this room. My mother was the very quiet kind. She would have her scotch, and it just was never empty. It was the same, you know, all you thought was she had one drink. She had one drink, but it was filled from the time you fixed dinner until the rest of the evening. And it's interesting to me because, I'll go a little ahead in my story, my mother actually had throat cancer, and as a result, she had an intranasal feeding tube and a trach. And she was not able to eat regular food or anything. And her favorite food was steak. And so one time I said to her, actually I wrote to her, she couldn't speak, I bet you really miss a good steak. She wrote, and baked potato and a scotch. And I knew that. One of the other things my mother said at that time, and everything she said to me at that time was on paper, is she said, I know that you'll take care of your father. And that was the hardest thing I ever read in my whole life, because if I go back to my childhood, I didn't like my dad very much. It's kind of a love-hate relationship. I wanted him to like me, but I wasn't crazy about him. He was a very funny man. He was a very intelligent man. He was also literally one of us. He had some bad attitude going on, and you did it his way or the highway. He was very controlling. We made a lot of jokes in our family. Zingers was the name of the game. He would say things to me like, move over so I can see City Hall. I mean, you know, my sisters, he would say, Carol got the brains, Nancy got the looks, Meryl got gypped. I mean, these were funny stories. And, you know, it's interesting because I laughed at those when they were told, you know, because I thought they were funny. But I know my dad loved me. I didn't know it until the last years of his life, but I know my dad loved me. And that's what this program brought to me. My parents had 7 children. The first 2 were girls. The third one was a girl. However, she died at 11 days of pneumonia. And at about 13 months later, I was born. And later on, I kind of felt like, okay, you're the 4th girl. Dad wanted a boy so bad. And I just always thought I was the replacement part. And I spent a lot of time trying to earn their approval. So what I was funny and I was smart. And I was probably mostly a smart ass. And, you know, and that's pretty much what I did. I felt invisible. The doctor told me when I was 7 that I had a weight problem. He told my mother that I needed to watch my weight. So when I went in the next time and I weighed more, he says, I thought I told her to watch her weight. My mom said she did. She watched it go up. And, you know, I thanked her for being feisty. But these were things that I battled from the very beginning. And then the other thing that kind of tacked on was I had depression. And I felt invisible all the time. I had very low self-esteem. And I never really quite fit in with the in crowd. And I spent a lot of time thinking there was something wrong with me. So by the time I got to be a teenager, I really thought I was a wallflower. I was pretty shy, didn't date much. The one guy that wanted to date me, I didn't want to date him. I told him my mother wouldn't let me date, and then my mother said, isn't he a nice guy? So we dated. And, sure. You know, these are things that, you know, I was doing what I should do or what I thought I should do. And the teens were very uncomfortable. In many ways. Like I said, I didn't fit in with the in crowd. However, I was part of, I don't know if there's any other people here. The high school I went to was a parochial high school. And they had the kids who were the popular kids, and the assumption was if you were a popular kid was that you were doing all the things you weren't supposed to be doing. And then if you were the goody two-shoes kid, then they thought that you weren't doing any of the things that you weren't supposed to be doing. But the fact of the matter is you were doing things you weren't supposed to be doing. They just didn't know you were doing them. And so I fell in that crowd, and I got away with a lot of things. But what was funny was that, you know, in all of this time, my parents believed that if I was going to drink as a teenager, which was okay with them, I should drink at home. I should learn to drink at home. So at 16, you A, got to go to college football games, and B, got to drink on Sundays. And so the wild and crazy stuff was, you know, these two people who I, you know, later came to find out were alcoholics were going to teach us how to drink responsibly. And so they did. And so anyway, part of that thing was, you know, I think I drank the progression that many people drink. I started with frou-frou drinks, you know, all the little mixy things with lots of sugar and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then I went to beer because it was cheap, and that was college. And, you know, and then, you know, I went on to the hard stuff. And you know, when I think about that, there were so many times that I had said, well, I'm not going to do that. Well, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. Well, I did a lot of those things. College was interesting. I went away as a freshman. I was very structured. I did not go out on school nights, just like high school. And then I partied on the weekends. And by the time football season started, I really knew how to do that. So Friday to Sunday was lost, and Monday through Thursday, I was in my class, I was doing my homework, I was getting the grades, I was doing what I was supposed to be doing. Sophomore year was a little different. Sophomore year, I was protesting the government, and I was, those of you that are way young, you know, bra burning and, you know, that kind of stuff, and marching on the Capitol, and there were lots of fun things that we did as college students that had nothing to do with the degree. I learned early on that in Tallahassee, I knew where every ladies' night was Sunday through Thursday. And on Friday and Saturday, I would just get some poor schmo to take me out and pay for the booze. And that worked for a long time. I started dating a guy. He was real serious right away, and I said, I can't do that. That doesn't work. Then I got into going out on blind dates. And the purpose of a blind date, fellas, I'd like you to know, is for me to get where I want to go. I really don't care who takes me there, and that was the point. I also worked part-time as a switchboard operator in the dorm, and the girls would call me, and when their dates would come, and they say, do I want to come down or don't I? And I would give them the, you know, thumbs up or thumbs down. But those were kind of the things. I found nickel beer night. And I could get drunk for a dollar, so that worked, and didn't ruin my budget at all, and that worked. But by the time I got to be a junior, it occurred to me that this was going to come to an end, and so I thought I better get a little bit serious and do what I'm supposed to do and pick a major and do that stuff. You will find it interesting. I picked criminology, and I was good at it. I do think like a criminal, and it helps. So we did those things, and as time moved along, in between my junior and senior year, toward the end of my junior year, my dad lost the house. He had not paid taxes in 5 years, and they sold it on the courthouse steps. And my brother-in-law called me and said, don't come home, because there's no house. And I was devastated. I was absolutely devastated. I really had a lot of things up until that point. I mean, a lot of material things. I was a very lucky person, very blessed person. I was so angry with my father because there was no reason for this other than the fact, which I now know, he's an alcoholic. He had gone from a job where he traveled to Europe to laying asphalt. Not that there's anything wrong with that. He did a few shady things over in Haiti and a couple other places, and eventually my mother supported the family with a sales clerk job, and life was very thin financially. So I figured I better hurry up and get out of school, and so I did exactly that. I hurried up and got out of school, and came home. And started working for the Mouse, because that is a rite of passage. If you live here, you got to work there. And I found a great group of companions. I don't know if any of you have ever worked for them, but certainly on the low end, they party all the time. They're not particularly involved with the sanctity of marriage. The bosses enjoy dating the employees, and the employees enjoy dating the bosses, and nobody cares. And I used to live in an apartment that one of our bosses lived in, and as he would leave for work, we'd wave. We were out by the pool. We had phoned in sick already. And, and he never said a word. But they had the nerve to tell us that one summer that we had to work 6 days a week, and if we didn't do that, it was going to go in our personnel file as being uncooperative. So I joined the union. And so these are, this is what my childhood was like. Lo and behold, along about the ripe old age of 23, when I thought I was very mature and quite worldly, I went to a wedding of one of my friends. The wedding was in St. Louis. I met a man who was going to school in Colorado, but lived in Ohio. And we hit it off right away. I was given a drink when I got off the airplane, and it was never empty until I got back on the airplane 4 days later. He was the first guy that I thought was really, really good, and by luck, he was a Midwest Irish Catholic. So, after we had actually seen each other in person a total of 12 days, he proposed. And I, of course, assumed this was a marriage made in heaven because God sent me a Midwest Irish Catholic. And he was the oldest of 13. He met all the criteria. It was a whirlwind romance. We had 3 kids in 3 years. And he was a dreamer. He really was a dreamer. You know, I know he loved me in the beginning because the man said he did. But in reality, I know he did. I know he did to the best of his ability. And unfortunately for me, we were both very immature. And unfortunately for him, we were both very immature. I was very controlling. One of our fights included a thrown telephone. And for those of you that are young, there was a time when telephones were connected to the wall. And when you throw it, there's this arc and then a drop. You know. And he didn't charge me with a, you know, deadly battery or assault or something. So we lived in another few years together. But, you know, we were married 13 and a half, 14 years by the time the divorce was over. And on one of the last Valentine's Day, he gave me a Valentine card that hurt my heart and at the same time told me the truth. And he said, "Happy Valentine's Day to someone who's easy to love." And you open it up and it says, "But hell to live with." And that is who I was. That is who I was. So, towards the end of that relationship, we kind of get into the what happened. And for that, I'm going to read a little something from today. And it's called Cultivating Faith. "I don't think we can do anything very well in this world unless we practice it, and I don't believe we do AA too well unless we practice it. We should practice acquiring the spirit of service. We should attempt to acquire some faith, which isn't easily done, especially for the person who has always been very materialistic, following the standards of society today. But I think faith can be acquired. It can be acquired slowly. It has to be cultivated. That was not easy for me, and I assume that it is difficult for everyone else." And that is today's reading from Reflections. And anyway, so what happened was, as we grew further and further apart, he was his father was a kidney patient, and he was the donor. And his father died as a result of really some negligence on the part of a physician. He was very overwhelmed, and he began drinking quite a bit. And this is the part that I find amusing. One of the things that I would do, because when he would drink quite a bit, he would also get angry. And so for a while, I threw some of the beers out. And then he got angry again because that was a waste of money. And so I would just drink them because I wasn't wasting any money and he wasn't going to get as angry, is at least what I told myself. You know, so that was crazy. And there was one other one that I often tell about, and this was a little bit earlier on. As I said, I'm not exactly young, and so you may have a hard time imagining this, but where you're having your picnic tomorrow at Warren Park, okay, when Detweiler turns into Judge Road, there used to be nothing there but an orange grove, a large orange grove. And I'd been up on, I believe it's Lake Underhill, with a friend, having just a little wine, but I'd forgotten to have lunch. And I came down Conway, yes. And I come around that bend, and my car caught the lip of the road and flipped. And I immediately panicked. Oh, my God, what am I going to do? Because if I get a DUI, I'm going to lose my job. And so the car's on its side, and I open the door and jump out, and people who are very concerned have stopped. Are you okay? Oh, yes, I'm okay. Help me write the car. So they did, and complete with grass coming out of it and a couple of broken mirrors and a crack in the side of the door, I took off. I don't even know if I said thank you, which, by the way, thank you. So anyway, so I got home, and my husband, who was clairvoyant, said, I was walking in the, oh, I forgot. I went to the car wash so that no one would know. Then I got home, and I walk in the door. My husband has not even come outside yet. He looks at my face. He says, "What'd you do to the car?" I thought, I'm never playing poker. I'm just never playing poker. So that's not going to happen. So so those were some things. At some point in here, I'm beginning to think this is not a good plan. And so as our custody wars became worse, I started going to a therapist. And a therapist said to me very calmly, "If I were you, I wouldn't drink." And I said, "Okay." And I decided not to drink. And I decided not to drink. And I really was very lucky because I was successful at that for a while. But you all know about that phrase, stark raving sober. You know, and that's what set in. And so one night after school, I went to, what was the name of that place? It's with the Le Cordon Bleu on Fairbanks. And we were going afterwards, and a lot of my friends were drinking, and I had my very favorite, cranberry and 7-Up, and they were laughing at me for paying $7 for a cranberry and 7-Up, and I said, you know, hey, it's the cost. It's just what it is. If you want the atmosphere, you got to pay. And I walked out into the parking lot, and I was saying goodbye to my friends. It was Christmas time. And someone came up behind me, and he says, I'm taking your purse. And I said, no, you're not. He said, yes, I am. I said, no, you're not. He said, yes, I am. And normal people don't do this, I don't think. So I'm on the ground, and and my friends pick me up, and we're all upset and whatever, and the policeman comes, and we tell him the story. And he says to me, well, what was in the purse? I said, well, it's a leather purse. Had my glasses. It's a leather wallet. I had $10 for milk and gas and a brand new Clinique that cost me $9.50. He says, that's grand theft. Because he says, no woman should pay $9.50. Now, but mind you, that was 24 years ago. So, that's kind of what happened. And this is when I started thinking, I think I'd better. I had friends that I worked with that were in AA, and they took me to a meeting, and they took me to the Friday night candlelight meeting at the greenhouse on Morris Boulevard. For those of you that don't remember, it was actually a greenhouse. And my husband has informed me I missed the first couple of greenhouses, that there was one at the S&H Green Stamp store on 1792. And then, of course, there have been several since and all of that. But I do remember that. And actually, both my coworkers were named Jim. And they took me to this meeting, and it was so wonderful because I knew I'd arrived. I'd been going to therapy for codependency for a year and a half. And the only thing that did is it made a lot of people not dead, because I was kind of homicidal at the time. But when I got to AA, I really kind of found myself, and it was so wonderful to be here. My first year was not fun. I came in October. In November, my dog died. In December, my mother was diagnosed as being terminally ill with throat cancer. And for those of you that don't know, that is a cancer that's related to alcohol and cigarettes. And in February, I took my comps for my master's, and I started my court proceedings for my divorce. In March, my brother got married. I got two tickets that day, by the way, because I have a little problem with control issues on the road sometimes. And in April, I got the final papers for my divorce. In May, I can't believe I did this. In January, my youngest brother died. It was a freak accident. He fell and cracked his skull. In May, my mother died on my dead brother's birthday. And this was my first year. And you know what? I think it kind of had to be this way, because if my first year had been easy, you know, all those people who are lucky enough to have pink clouds, I wouldn't still be here. I would take it for granted. Everything I've ever had in my life that I had value for, I'd worked for, I'd fought for. You know, the whole claw marks thing. And so in June, I had my dad committed, and in July, I had an ulcer, and that was my, you know, pretty much how it went. And people would say, "Oh my God, you have an ulcer too?" And I go, "I think I earned it." You know, I worked hard for this. So we did that. And I had a sponsor who was very spiritual, and I really needed spirituality. As I said, I was somewhat homicidal, and I was definitely suicidal. And so she kind of helped me through all that. And, you know, the readings that I've read about cultivating faith and I'm a miracle, that's why they're so important. Because even though I'd gone to church all through this whole thing, I didn't have faith. I didn't have faith that I was going to be okay. I didn't have faith that God was going to take care of me, because I am one of His miracles. And for those of you that are not religious, that's fine. A lot of people think when you talk about God, you're talking about religion. I'm talking about spirituality. And all I can say about religions is, you know, they're the vehicle, and some of us drive Corvettes and some of us drive Chevys. So anyway, you know, it's okay. I didn't do things the way you were supposed to do them, of course. Took me a while to get the perfect sponsor. I did the thing that many, many people do. I waited to find the perfect sponsor. And then once I found her, she kind of taught me to have a life. And I did the things where you go to the picnics and you go to the dances and you go to the workshops and you go to all those things and you start meeting people and that. And along about 3 years sober, I finally did my 90 and 90. And I have to tell you, if you have never done 90 and 90, you will be spiritual by the time you get finished. And if not just that, you may also be graced with being somewhat serene, mildly serene. So anyway, at that particular point in time, I was working four jobs, and I met a gentleman at the Southside Club that many of you know to be my husband. Not that other one. And I love the twinkling in his blue eyes. Let's face it, I wasn't listening a whole lot at first. And I found myself going to the meetings he went to, and then I got to hear what he really had to say. And he is a beautiful man. He is a beautiful, beautiful man. And I just want to say some things, because they fill my heart. And that is, and I better hurry up. My youngest daughter had, we'd gone to the dentist, thought it was going to be a normal trip. They changed their, you know. So the guy is drilling in there. He says, "I'm sorry, she's going to have a root canal, and she has to have it now because it's open." And I said, okay, how do we do that? He says, well, you have to go to somebody else. And I said, oh. And he says, and you have to have, and I can't remember what it was back then, but I think $600 or $800. And I, as a single mom, did not have $600 or $800. I was lucky if I had $6 or $8. And I called my ex-husband, who was my daughter's father of record, and and he said to me, sounds like a personal problem. I give you child support. Mind you, he gave me $300 a month for three children, which didn't go far. But anyway, I got all my gumption up and I called this nice man and I said, I really need some help. Would you loan me $600? And he says, I don't have $600 on me. He says, but I do have my credit card. I'll bring it down. He took a few minutes before he actually brought it to the dentist office because he stopped to buy my daughter a dozen roses and said, no little girl should have to go without dental work. I love that man from that moment on. I loved him because he loved me and loved my children. And for those of you who are gentlemen who are trying to date women who have children, that is the way to win them. So, just in case you need any dating tips, because my... Anyway, okay. The funny part was, we decided to get married. We went to a couples meeting, and this couples meeting was actually down near where you're going to have your picnic. It's not there anymore. And many couples in that meeting got married. And many couples in that meeting have had subsequent children, yada, yada, yada. And we learned how it was an open AA meeting with Al-Anon there. And I want you to know, those Al-Anons had black belts. And they were good. They were very good. And it really taught us the... I'm going to pick on Chip. He said it was always a C word that we talked about. It was communication. It was... What are some of the other ones?
Commitment.
Oh, yeah, that one. And then, you know, and then there were all those kind of things. So we actually learned how to put the principles in our lives. And I don't know if any of you read the principles over there, but I do want to read them or say them at least momentarily for you. Because they are honesty, hope, faith, courage, integrity, willingness, humility, brotherly love, justice, perseverance, spiritual awareness, and service. And I will say to you that if you put those principles in your life, you're golden. Anybody can live by those principles. Those principles mean more to me than anything I can think of. I can give you the Ten Commandments and all that other stuff, but that's not what does it for me. And so anyway, I wanted to get into what it's like now. And for that, I picked March 5th, a lifelong task. But just now in these circumstances, does a fella take it easy? That's what I want to know. And then it goes into, I was never known for my patience. How many times have I asked, why should I wait when I can have it all right now? Indeed, when I was first presented the 12 steps, I was like the proverbial kid in a candy store. I couldn't wait to get to step 12. It was surely just a few months' work. And so I thought, I realize now that living the 12 steps of AA is a lifelong undertaking. As a matter of fact, when I was in therapy, I was ready to start with the fourth step. And my therapist very nicely told me that if you're driving a car, you don't start in fourth gear. So, all right. So what's it been like? I was thinking about all the things that we've done and all the, you know, all the good stuff, all the not so good stuff. And I want people to know that are newcomers. You know what? Life doesn't go away just because you get sober. I can't tell you how many hurricanes I've been in. I've been in two tornadoes, We had a fire at the house. We'd had a robbery at the house. We'd been in a tsunami. We had rebellious teenagers, ungrateful children. We worked very hard to keep our head above water. A couple years ago, my husband had a quadruple bypass. 2 years ago, he had prostate cancer. I've been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, and I've had a heart cath, and I have allergies and asthma and bronchitis. And you know what? This is normal. Oh, and by the way, they're still telling me I have to lose weight. So, you know, so these are the things that, you know, when you kind of get in here, you say to yourself, you know, this is the business of living. We had a noon meeting one time, and we were talking about death, and I told them what I was told. None of us are getting out of here alive. You know, you might try, but, you know, let's face it, we're all going. So the deal is make the journey a good one and enjoy what's happening while you're here. I do have a husband who loves me. I do have grown-up children who are really pretty good kids. We have our battles, and I typically have at least one that I'm feuding with on occasion. They have their own lives. It's been very hard for me to understand it is their own lives. That's been something that's been difficult for me. My job is very fulfilling, and I keep very busy. When I first met Gypsy, I told him I had 4 jobs, 3 kids, 2 dogs, and a boyfriend. And now I only have 1 job, which I'm very happy. The kids are all gone. And, well, I take that back. One is still living with us. But he's not there a lot. So my husband and I are now having the kind of relationship that people have in the beginning of their marriages. Only we've been together, what is it, 17, 18 years, something like that. How long have we been married? 18?
We'll be married 18 there. In July, but we've been together 22.
Yeah. So, all right. And the other things that I've had a wealth of, yeah. Yes, thank you, dear. Yeah. I had to include it. How I had to include it, yeah. So anyway, I think some of the things I'm most grateful for the program is certainly my marriage and my family. But I'm also very grateful for the wealth of friends that I have. When I came in tonight, everybody was so good. How are you doing? Is it you that's speaking? Maybe not. I think I'll go see what they do. But you know, it was so warm to know that people cared. I haven't talked too much about my siblings. I love my siblings very much, but I got to tell you. They do not think like I think. They have known me for a very long time. I believe we're running at 61 and a half years now. And they still think I'm going to the Friday night couples meeting. So I'm just going to let them think that, because whenever they want to do a get together, we say, oh, it has to be on Saturday because you go to the couples meeting. I go, no. Saturday I go to the speaker's meeting. And but anyway, they don't care. But I mean, I feel safe here. I feel as safe here as I did the first time I got here. And I love Central because, as I tell my friends, it is everything from soup to nuts. And I know that I'm in the nuts category, so don't be offended if I've included you there. I also have had, you know, when we talk about the gift of service, I love my sponsees. I just think they're wonderful. And I'm glad that that I've had the opportunity to be a part of their lives. I know there are thousands and thousands of things that when people share their story, you know, someone will say, oh, I can relate to that, or I can relate to that. I don't know if anybody can relate to what I'm saying. I hope you can relate to what I'm feeling. But the fact of the matter is, As the saying goes, I'm a happy customer, and I'll keep coming back. And thank you very much for your time tonight.